Welcome to Belt to Loda, the officially unofficial podcast for The Expanse on AMC. No, that's not right. Amazon Prime. I got sci-fi. I got so many letters. I almost said Expanse on GME. I really almost said Expanse on GME.
No,
it's on Amazon Prime.
Betting the house on these diamond hands to get a season six because, oh, Lord, this is hoping to, in the future.
I'm hoping to get a Winnipesaukee at home after this whole thing's over.
Here you go.
So with his very own rocket. This is episode 10 of season 5 called Nemesis Games. It's the season finale. Kind of all been building up to this. Nemesis Games, of course, the name of book number 5, which most of the events that happen in this are based on. I think you said they're sticking with that trend. They've done this in previous seasons.
Last episode of the season usually is named after the book. I think there might be an exception, maybe in season 2 and
season 2-3 was weird, right? Because they were like half seasons stuffed into two seasons and it was strange.
They riffle shuffled the books into two separate seasons and you might have had some weird stops, but we saw Nemesis Games. Also, we got late in the week last week, we got screeners for this as we were kind of hoping. So you're hearing this probably a lot sooner than we talked about in the last episode. So because we're able to get this out right in the nick of time. What'd you think of the finale episode, Jim?
I liked it. I thought it brought it all around. You know, this season was strong. I don't think it's the best season of The Expanse, but I also don't think it's a bad season. Expanse doesn't really have bad seasons, and this was no exception. It emotionally was like super resonant at the end, all this stuff with Naomi finally making it back to the ship and back to her crew and her people, and playing that message for Holden was a great moment. I really liked, you know, Amos's goodbye with Eric, even though Eric's a bit of a scoundrel. You know, you can see there was a relationship there once that works. Claire finds a new home. It's all really strong stuff taking us into season 6.
I was surprised at how much I liked it. Like, I thought I was going to like it. You know, I was confident that there wouldn't be a misstep, but I thought some of the things, you know, like the way they dealt with this Alex situation was such a great handling the reality of the situation, which is Cass Anvar has to go with the other reality of situations that we love Alex and Alex didn't do anything wrong.
Sure.
Like, Alex, the character, is still great and he gets to die as a hero to save his family and buried with full military honors. And the way the show handled that, like, shocked me. Like, I wasn't expecting it. And in retrospect, feels very good. And they're also doing a lot of obvious moves. I think the bull as Alex theory is all but confirmed. He's drinking out of the man's coffee cup in this episode, sitting in the man's Barca lounger.
Yeah.
Getting injected with the man's juice. I think he will be Alex by the time next season rolls around.
The very same juice that killed him. Nah, I bet the penis has inferior juice. You know, the Martian juice is the stuff you want.
Yeah, probably. Although racing juice, dangerous. Maybe not for the older pot-bellied, Martian veterans. Maybe you leave that for the young kids. That borderline illegal racing juice.
I mean, his Martian body couldn't handle the Earther juice. I get it. You know, they got different drugs for different people.
And I also feel dumb because this show roped me in. Like, I thought the protomolecule was dealt with. I thought the ring gate was impregnable, and that fucking slippery fish, Marco, the ghost knife fish, with another goddamn micrometeor storm and some nifty torpedo decoy work, is in a really strong position with these weirdo, almost religious fanatic Martian separatists. That is a fascinating development. But what I'm saying is, like, all of the emotional beats hit, like Holden and Naomi reconciling and playing that message and how it was meant for her, but it also works beautifully as saying goodbye to Alex. When Drummer opens the hailing frequencies and says, Holden, it's Drummer, like, you know, and when she pulls the gun on Corral, all that stuff was so exciting and so well done. One of the best executed space battles we've had thus far, too.
Yeah, a lot of good tension in this episode. The way they played with tension in the last few episodes of this season was great. That stuff where, like, the character's desire to get the outcome they want is the very thing that could destroy the whole situation for them, right? That stuff is so good when you're pitting a character against themselves, essentially.
Yeah. And it's fun for me too to also see like the shape of the next season to come. You know, like I've long wanted Bobby to be part of the Rocinante. It looks like there's a path open for that. If nothing else, for optics. Yet, you know, like Avastral is very intent on having this like functional family that has at least one Earther, one Belter, and one Martian, and we're one Martian short. You know, Bull's a Terran, so we need another Martian on board the Rocinante or her little.
True.
Her little mixed family metaphor that she's very invested in. And honestly, Marco is too. Like, Marco has got a hate boner for the Rocinante, probably a lot because of Naomi. Mm-hmm. But also, like, it is a symbol of unity. It is, it puts to the lie everything that he says.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I wonder if Earth is and Mars is ready to really live up to what, you know, the commitment of the Rocinante is, because it's not like Naomi's a second class citizen on that ship. She's second in command and everyone gets an equal share. Mm-hmm. Like, is that like, if you treated the Belters like that from the jump, we wouldn't be in this situation. So it's all really good. And the emotional stuff all worked well. There was laughs like that, you know, the Eric and Amos goodbye had one of the kind of the funniest and sneaky, funny situations, in the series so far. And I really liked it. It's another strong finale.
Yeah.
So do you want to get into the detailed conversation thing that we do?
Yeah, I think we should.
And also before we get too far, what's your feelings about a wrap up pod? Cause I'm kind of pro wrap up pod.
We could do one. Yeah. Well, I'll see why not.
Yeah, I feel like because I want to do a bunch of because like now I'm unleashed. I want to do a bunch of reading on and listen to some other podcasts, because a lot of people said that some of the quibbles I've had of Naomi stuff is stuff that was addressed in various threads and podcasts. Now, I don't know how I feel about all that, but like I do want to see what's out there. And I imagine people would like to talk about the season now that everything's caught up and done with. So, I still have a lot of enthusiasm for The Expanse. I'm really looking forward to reading Nemesis games now. But let's break it down. Let's break this episode down.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and ball move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
As the Rocinante speeds towards the Chainsmoker to rescue Naomi, Monica wants to review torpedo tracking logs from their fight with the Zemea, and Bull charges in to report that they've walked right into a trap.
Oh, no. I don't have any notes for this scene because it's not like it's just a setup scene. I don't know.
Well, so they do a couple of things that they set up here. Number one is, like, as soon as she started wanting to pull tracking logs, my heart sank because I'm like, oh, fuck, it's a goddamn protomolecule.
Mm-hmm.
I should have known. They played the old Naomi trick, put on a torpedo. And the other thing they set up is this Bull's free use of slurs.
Yeah.
Fictional future space slurs. He gets the Mickeys in here. He gets the Skinnies in here. It's very upsetting. Like, you know, Monica comments on it, and it's going to be it's just something he's going to have to get over if he's going to be the Alex of the ship. You know, mm-hmm. So I thought that was pretty good, and it is established the fact that the Rocinante is a tough ship, but it's already depleted half of its defensive stores, and it's going against these ships that are, you know, outgun and outnumber them heavily. There's no way they can win. That's the important thing about this. The scene. And then Drummer, along with her faction and two of Marco's big gun, heavy hitting Martian warships, are on the hunt for the Rocinante.
I love this stuff because, like, I feel like we're getting a tail of the tape here. Like, we're sizing up the ships, right? You get these big hero shots sweeping across each of them.
And in this corner, the Kyoto and the Sierra Mal with 16 guns and three rail in place. Yeah, it's like, yeah, exactly.
And they look so badass. I really love these ships.
Has a reach of 32,000 nautical miles.
Right.
Gross weight of 650,000 tons. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Very cool.
A lot of cool character beats, too. Like, you know, Naomi's lover, or not Naomi, Drummer's lovers. It's Oksana. Who's the guy?
I don't know his name.
They probably mentioned it, and if I was had the subtitles for these things, I would have known it by now. But this guy, it's called Pete. Oksana and Pete are talking about, like, you know, what they're going to do with Drummer, and they're trying to, like, you know, you don't have to be there. We can. She responds, I like this line. I don't look away from what I do. And he tries to, like, hey, come on, Kamina. And she's like, nope, captain now, Kamina later. Like, she's all business, and she's going to go through with this thing to keep her family safe. And Oksana, like, they discussed, like, that she's burnt all of her bridges. There's no way. She's, like, she's pulled the gun out of her holster for the last time. It's all going to be up to this guy. Mm-hmm. Which sets up an interesting kind of power play later on in the episode. And the, you know, her inevitable betrayal of Marco. I looked into some of these ship names. So you've got the Koto, which is a Japanese stringed instrument. It's this kind of like long, almost like harp. It's or like a harp, but with a guitar body, and it like sits in a person's lap. A lot of times, it's played like a big, like a big keyboard,
like a zither
about that size. I don't know. It's a koto. So it's a Japanese stringed instrument. And then on the other hand, you got Serio Mall, which as well is Serio is a Spanish word for a very serious or solemn individual or thing, and Mall is bad. So I think this is like, think of like John Wick.
Deadly like,
this
serious.
This is a very bad. This is a very deadly serious. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I think is the flavor you're supposed to get from this ship. Hmm. I like the effort they put into the naming of things, even when
that's
I don't understand.
That's a pretty badass
name.
Yeah,
yeah, Serio Mall. Yeah, sounds like something from The Good, the Bad, the Ugly.
Yeah.
And it's probably the bad and the ugly wrapped together. So, Holden and Bull, they're no dummies. They saw the tail of the tape. They realize there's no escaping this fight, so they decide to make like Leroy Jenkins and lead a doomed charge against the superior numbers and firepower of the Belter fleet trapping them to give Naomi a little bit more time to be rescued.
Yeah. They don't. I'm not sure. They try and explain kind of what this gets them, you know, as a symbol that Marco wants to destroy. I'm not sure I quite understand what saving Naomi and getting the Rossi destroyed accomplishes.
I think it's that there's no way they can run. And if they turn
but
around
why
now,
is
and
that
fight,
true? These are a bunch of Belters and they're outside of missile range. Are they just too much momentum? Is the orbital like mechanics not lining up for them or something? Like,
didn't Holden say in the previous episode that they're burning a lot of extra fuel to get there quicker? So like, so maybe they just literally can't thrust that long.
Okay, that would make sense. And Bull does mention in this episode, so yeah.
Yeah, so I think that there's like they can't run, they can fight, and if they sprint around right now, that lengthens the apparent distance between them and Naomi and the actual rescue operation. They might be able to damage one and take them out. I think it's just more of like, you know, hey, if we can buy them another hour or two,
yeah.
Then because I do believe that the Screaming Eagle, the Screaming Firehawk, can outrun. You know, could just burn towards the core worlds and
for sure.
and get to safety. I do think because like Bull's all like war mad, you know, he's like pissed that they're in this situation. He's pissed at Holden. I thought Holden like his like, hey, look, I'll accept my level of responsibility, but never forget that we're out here because this maniac killed our friend, fucked up the Earth, and declared a war. Like, we're not out here to save my girlfriend. We're out here to stop all this stuff. And we've kind of gotten embroiled in this situation. So shut the fuck up and sit down. But Bull's more frustrated just by, like he said, it's like, you know, I hate getting killed before you even get to start fighting, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he's impotent is what he feels. And I also liked Monica's, like, wait, what expression on her face when she sees these guys talking about, like, oh, we're just going to. And I kind of wish we'd gotten a little bit more time with the other Belters and the other crew of the Tycho, because holy shit, this just became a suicide mission.
Yeah, I mean, it did change tone a little bit, but like, I don't know, when Monica's so insistent that she be included on this mission, I don't think she can, you know, really complain too much.
No.
She knew she that she was in for, right. And she doesn't. So credit to her. They do give her a moment to go,
Yeah. Because that's the civilian. It's all, you know, one thing to live through a dire situation and think you're big and bad, but now to like, okay, well, there's almost no way we're walking out of this. And I'm glad that they let her be concerned without like, you know, tearfully going to them and be like, oh, guys, please, is there some other way? Because there isn't. And she knows that. And she also knows she made her bed. She's going to lie in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice. It's nice. There's also just a brief scene of Bobby and Alex reacting to Jim's noble charge into the teeth of the Belters. I thought that was pretty good too.
Yeah, they know it's a suicide mission as well.
Yeah. And, you know, Alex got a little husk in his voice as he's saying, "We'll get it back, Jim. Go give him hell.
Yeah. I mean, that's his farewell message to Holden. You know, it's like
pretty much. Yeah.
I know this means everything to you. We'll get it done.
And he also is trying to take advantage by like pushing the limits again. They're going to go back under full thrust to try to get a little bit, you know, because like I was even thinking this is like, Jesus Christ, like the braking and you're accelerating again. Like this has got to be pretty high risk behavior. And of course, it is.
Yeah.
So
yeah, we'll talk about that.
So Naomi, we cut back to her and she's doing the thing she was trying to do last episode, banging on stuff. Mm-hmm. Which is this, she was trying to open a nozzle that feeds one of those RCS control thrusters on the side of the ship. She successfully, after really whacking on it, bangs it open and it's able to thrust the chain smoker off course for about 4 seconds. But since, you know, Newton says once objects in motion stays in motion, that lateral brief thrust is enough to take the chain smoker into just a spiral orbit now. It's essentially giving an intergalactic yard job to the Milky Way.
And I was wondering what this gains her. And I eventually realized on second watch, it gives her time, because the thing she needs here is to keep the Screaming Firehawk from getting close enough to detonate this proximity sensor on this bomb. Yep. And, you know, with the trouble later that Alex has, and I think they do a really good job of showing here how like this screws with his straight ahead approach to docking with the ship.
Yeah, it's now a high G turning docking scenario.
It takes him who knows how long to set up this maneuver and execute it. And he's got to like get it in just the right position. It's still risky. It's cool. I really like what they did.
And you'll be forgiven if you don't understand, because in the first watch, I'm like, well, I don't stand. So it deviates, like it just like it'd be like on the highway if a car just like kind of veered left for a second and then came back. But the crucial thing you have to realize is this is actually like you take the steering wheel and you just turn it a little bit and it just stays there.
Yeah,
because unless there's a thruster to knock it back the other way, it's always going to have this yawing attitude that's going to turn it into the spiral. So now it's just sitting there and doing circles in space, which is dangerous to dock, and you know, just it just slows things down a little bit. It doesn't necessarily work in the end, but you know,
there's some risk there too. If she were to, you know, if this gas were to spin her a little too fast, you know, she could black out from the G's.
Oh like, yeah,
it's a pretty risky thing, but at this point, she's out of options.
Yeah, and I thought they did a good job of selling the high G, because like when the helmet starts to roll vertically, you know, horizontally on the deck.
And she looks at it and she smiles because she knows that she's accomplished it. Yeah, it's really nice. Really nice moment.
And again, they don't really take the time to expect you. They fully expect you to like keep up, man. Like, you know, she banged on the thruster. Yeah. There's a one sign thing where I think it's either Alex or Bobby say that she's in a spiral now, and that's it. Like, you know, you have to kind of understand space mechanics. So, and there's even like, you know, all this stuff that like, it's so clever how they use this to say goodbye to Alex, but they're already setting up like how dangerous this is. And they did this before. This isn't something they wrote, you know, just in case, you know, Cass Anvar goes rogue. They talked about this with Avastral and Bobby using a Screaming Firehawk, how like, you know, especially older people, and Alex isn't as old as Avastrala, but he's at least a decade older than everyone else on the Rocinante.
That sounds right. Yeah.
I think you're supposed to understand he's in his late 40s and everybody else is in their, you know, early 30s. So, you know, he's that maybe has a weakened sidewall in his vessels or something. So, but they talk about that and all the dangers. And I thought that's pretty cool. Their next scene, and this is a big one. This is good. This is a lot of episode. After preparing for battle, the Rocinante engages the combined Belter hunting party. Drummer takes advantage of the fog of war to turn the tide of the battle. Let's just talk about the whole fucking thing.
Okay, and this is like also intercut a little bit with the Alex and Bobby stuff. Is that right?
No.
This happens right before this.
Yeah.
Gotcha. It starts with Holden shutting down the Skinny's shit, right? the Bull's pulling.
Yeah.
Like he tells him, you know, not to say that again, which I like
Bull. Ships. They're Bull. Like fanning out and, you know.
What is this guy doing? Does he not realize that he's talking about Naomi? Every time he says skinnies, Holden is hearing, I hate your girlfriend. Like, the hell?
I'll say this. I have some sympathy to veterans that fight wars against people where it's like the dirtiest fighting. Like if you go, sure. If you fought like in Iwo Jima and you came away from that hating Japanese people, or you had a buddy's head blown in half in Iraq and you feel a certain way about Muslims. Mm-hmm. Like I understand that, but part of returning to society is learned like letting that go to what extent right. possible. And Holden is like, you know, it's like, I get it. Like these people are just your fucking enemy that you yeah. have bled in the mud. And if you swap blood and mud or whatever the shit they talked about with Fred, but like, you got to stop it because yeah, that is my girlfriend. Mm-hmm. That is my best friend pilot. Who's about to heroically sacrifice himself to save said girlfriend. Yep. And you got it. So I thought it was really good. It wasn't, you know, Holden's like, I'm not passing judgment. I'm not doing this. And he even says, yeah. like, I understand mm-hmm. you got a lot of history of these people and you're trying to work yourself up into a battle frenzy.
And everybody's pissed, right? Holden's pissed. Sure. Like the entirety of the well wallers are pissed. Like,
yeah. Yeah. You can't be saying that also. Like, I'm just thinking like most of his crew are belters. I know. Too.
That's a thing.
Like your Tom's open is like, what the fuck? Bull, what shut? Yeah. Yeah. Whatever.
Yeah.
Well, Walla.
For the good of the crew, he's got to shut his mouth. But yeah, this is awesome. You know, drummer, you know, claims a misfire after firing the first round of torpedoes and Carol like hits her head when she's bashed with a fire extinguisher or whatever.
Why does drummer do this? Was she always planning to do this? Because it almost seemed like there was like these wheels spinning in her head and she'd kind of like, I don't think it's well thought out. It's just that she saw the opportunity. Carl was distracted by the imminent battle and she saw an opportunity to change things.
And I think like that idea of, you know, she's headed out. She's on a mission and it's coming down to it where she's going to have to push the button to kill Naomi's boyfriend. Can she do that? Can she make that call? And it's one thing to say, okay, I'm gonna do that, but when you actually get down to it and you have to do it and the moment is here, she was unable to do that. That's kind of how I feel. Like Naomi has been yeah. circulating in the back of her head.
And they have these really great ways to build tension in the space battles because, like, you know, you have to, like, this is like the old timey ships, you have to rig it for battle. Like everyone has to get in a spacesuit because you take a PDC round or a rail cannon round, suddenly the whole ship's vented. So everyone's got to get in their suits. Everyone's got to get like all the weapons all sorted. And there's all this last minute activity and allows everyone to go from ship to ship and see everyone looking serious in their helmets. And the music, like a lot of people talk shit about the Expanse music or say it's like, oh, you know, man. It's not super distinctive. I won't say that like I ever hum a lot of the Expanse theme, except for maybe the credits, but like it's really good in like that Battlestar Galactica way of yeah. like getting you amped and jacked and building those moments of tension. And that moment where you've got this music, you've got the countdown on the scanners, the five Belter ships getting closer to Rossi in the middle and panning from drummer to Corral. And then she pulls, it's really exciting. And so what it I think is. Happens is drummer shoots and disables Ashford's old ship.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
I think so. She disables that ship.
It's tough to tell. These space battles, I want to say, are a little bit jumbled. Like even though they show those tail of the tape pans across their bows early on, I still can't really tell them apart in frenzied firefights.
I just think that like the Martian ships are very distinctive, and it looked like the three Erector set ships are drummers, and it looked like one of the Erector sets filed on the other Erector set and disabled it.
They're definitely trying to disable like the bigger gunships here. That's like one of her first targets. I know the Kodo is targeted second, I think, with that other volley.
Yeah. And then I think her boyfriend on the Pete. He fires the last at the biggest Martian warship.
Yeah.
So I think it, like, they take out whatever Ashford's ship is, and then, because that's the other thing, is like, when the impact hits, like, the Belters, like, slam forward, and that was one of Drummer's ships. So I think she took out one of her own just to disable it to get it out of the fight. Mm-hmm. Took out one of the other, and then the Rocinante gets into it. And it's fucking exciting. Like, Carol gets the upper hand, like one of Drummer's dudes mutinies and bear hugs her. Carol gets her at gunpoint, and then one of the little baby Belters that was, like, one of the most outspoken against joining the Marco's cause, like, mm-hmm. just waylays her with a fire extinguisher, kills her. One shot. Yeah, it's fucking that's a lot of mass swinging out of someone's head. She's doing the Han Solo thing where, like, obviously the Koto is like furious, like, what the fuck are you doing? And she's like, I've got a had a weapons malfunction over here, large leak, very dangerous.
Right.
And then it's just the Belter heavy frigate versus Rocinante. And you're like, I was thinking, damn, maybe it can win. Mm-hmm. Maybe it can win because like they're just going to do this full high speed guns blazing pass. Anything that can happen. But then Pete launches every fucking missile on the Defotang. I think that's the name of that ship. At the last Martian frigate, and something happens. I don't quite understand it. I'm not sure if time is slowing down for us to see, but there's, like, this little purple satellite glowing thing.
Yeah.
Which I'm like, is that, cause you know, I played this game FTL where you've got, like, defense drones that kind of circle the ship and not, like, mm-hmm. is this like a next level PDC that kind of orbits the ship, or is this a weapon that they fired that shoots, like, some purple shit at the Martian thing that makes it explode? I don't know, but the frigate goes boom at the end of the day.
Right, that's all you really need to know. I definitely couldn't tell what that was, but it was interesting.
I thought maybe reading the book you would, like, oh, well, here's the thing, they have this experimental Martian weapon system and blah blah blah, or this is the ghost knife that Ashford pioneered back in the Belter War of 2319 or something.
Marco's ghost knife shows up later in the form of micro asteroids, pretty amazing, but we'll get there
for sure.
Cool. It's exciting. Oh yeah, it's amazing. Like, I really like this flavor of space battle. You know, it's not Star Wars, right? It's a little more grounded in reality. Yeah. A little more. It's not even Star Trek, because Star Trek tends to be, like, slower, at least in the way it's shot. Like these are big hulking ships, sort of, like, you know, just hanging out there. Whereas these seem a little more nimble, but also once you get on a trajectory, that's kind of just the way you're going.
And it's so fast, and the distances, like,
right.
In Star Trek, it's filmed like Napoleonic era, 18th century Age of Sail. Like, yes. These ships ponderously move. I mean, they're supposed to be going to fractional speeds of light, and they're just, like, ponderously passing each other and doing these low bank turns. But in The Expanse, like, one of the reasons it's so hard to follow is once a torpedo hits and shoots it, the camera just jumps.
Yeah.
Was probably thousands of kilometers through space to like show you some other action of the battle, because they're not, like, it's always ridiculous in space battles when you have, like, 10 Romulan cruisers against, I don't know, 17, like, these ships in reality would be firing from, like, outside visual range. And The Expanse does that. The mm-hmm. Expanse feels like real space combat. And even if it's hard to follow sometimes, it's super cool to watch.
Yeah. Chaotic. I was surprised that Drummer had to fight this hard against her own ships. I kind of assumed that if Drummer gave the word, all of her crew, or most, like 99% of her crew, would rebel with her. But
it's not the case.
Yeah, it doesn't appear to be.
And I felt like I kind of thought so too, but also they've done a really good job of showing how the rest of her crew might have gotten skeptical about, like, hey, do you put us, like, are we a what's first, the safety of the family or some other cause or some other entanglement? This, you know, bitch we don't even know, Naomi, for example.
Yeah.
I thought they'd done a really good job of kind of, like, laying those personal politics. So, you know, the majority of the crew went along, but you needed a couple of lucky breaks here and there. But, you know, like, it's such a moment. Even though this is, like, the battle's over, it was such a moment when Drummer finally gets a hold of Holden and, you know, says it's me. It's a real moment. I'm just like, yeah, like, fuck yeah. Cause that's what I was, you know, I've been saying this since episode 5. I was like, I don't know, but at some point Drummer and Holden will be on the same side in this battle. It's going to be fucking cool. And yeah, paid off.
Yep.
Meanwhile, on board the Chainsmoker, Namely realizes that nothing that she's done so far is going to deter Alex from docking with this damn thing to rescue her. So she prepares to make one final spacewalk. But to our surprise, Naomi is recovered successfully, and we're forced to say goodbye to a great pilot and a good compadre, one Alex Kamal.
Yeah, man. I love these scenes. So we've talked about some of the action scenes in this show, especially this season not being shot from particularly exciting angles. And this is one that's also very close up. But this one, the close up felt right because of the emotion of the scene. The desperation that you get to see on Naomi's face and the fear. And
oh, I loved it,
man. I can't even imagine just throwing yourself out of a ship into nothing, knowing that's it.
With no air.
No air. Yeah. You're dead in, you know, 5 minutes. Yeah, it's really, really cool. I love how they stick with Naomi's face through 99% of this scene.
Such a great artistic decision.
When Bobby shows up, right? And you can sort of like the way they play the sound design in the show is so good because you're kind of on the edge of consciousness with Naomi, right? And being out in space, you're not hearing a lot of things except through suit contact and it's literally contact.
Yeah, conductive, like, you know,
the vibrations of their voice, and that's how Belters communicate, you know. And so, like, you've got Bobby showing up, and you get the impression that like she's got one hand on her, right, and she's fiddling with a hose to try and hook it up to her air supply.
It's the umbilical system, yeah.
And you can kind of hear what she's saying a little bit because it's coming through like the glove, maybe on her shoulder or something.
Right, right, right.
And then when she actually gets a hold of her and gets like her arms around her and her helmet up against her helmet. Yeah,
which we've seen before. We've seen people talk helmet to helmet without any cons before in the show.
Yeah. So I loved it, man. I thought this thing was just brilliantly shot.
It was. I want to talk about some problems with it later, but yeah, I just want to echo all those decisions. Like, we hang like inside Naomi's helmet for like almost the entirety of this thing. And, you know, I was thinking like, maybe Naomi does die, or she doesn't get to her, because like someone sent in an email or maybe tweeted at me. Like, what if, why would Naomi just blow herself up?
Mm-hmm.
Because we've got all these tamper, and actually I found myself, that's one of, I guess, a problem is that her jumping out and trying to do these Belter hand signals seems like a Hail Mary.
It is.
Whereas what if she just taken like her little spanner and pried off one of those tamper things and blown the ship up, that would have absolutely saved Alex and Bobby. It almost is like,
yeah.
Like, I feel like, again, this show got a little too clever for itself. Overall, I really like the Naomi Chainsmoker plot, but I think they cut a few corners and maybe should have spent some more time in the writer's room asking questions about this stuff. If they're going to blow, you know, turn this into a, because it doesn't seem like this was as much of a meal in the books.
No, it's a big meal.
Really?
A lot of this is a meal. It's just different because Naomi, her whole approach to this is very much from the, like, her potentially committing suicide angle. And it's really like, it kind of portrays her as, you know, typically how women are portrayed in media, where like, oh, you know, the only thing that matters is their kid. And like, if they can't have that, they're going to kill themselves. And it's just like, It's so much better in the show. And I feel like maybe part of the reason she doesn't just blow up the ship and killing herself and saving her friends is because they didn't want that to play into it at all. Like that thought was never in her head. I'm not going to kill myself, because if I kill myself, Marco wins, you know. It's I don't know. Then I leave Philip for good. Right. I think there's a lot of like, she doesn't want Marco to win this in any way. And if whether she dies or the Rossi dies, that's a victory for Marco.
Yeah, I just felt, and look, it's tough because when you got a personal loan in a survival situation, like we saw this with Tom Hanks and Castaway, like there's only so many ways you can get these people talking to themselves and explaining right. what the hell they're doing. And short of like getting the bloody volleyball in there, you know, you've got just, you know, like I felt it was all very natural. The remarks that she, you know, when she calls like Alex a brave idiot and when she's, you know, whimpering about this or that, I thought this was all natural. But like, I did wonder, it's like, well, like if this doesn't work, then you're dead. And so is Alex and Bobby. But if you just blew the ship up, I wish there was a technical reason why she couldn't have. And I just felt like, again, this lowers this is the first time I've ever seen The Expanse kind of take these kind of shortcuts, and maybe they're not even shortcuts, but yeah, she jumps out there. She does the Belter emergency hand signal.
I fucking love the signal for kaboom. It's just,
yeah. It felt like she's, because like first it felt like she's doing this weird, like Haka kind of like war dance thing. Cause you know, but yeah, it's like, and Alex, of course, I guess, knows the Belter sign. I wonder where he picked that up, and the ice hauling stuff, probably. Yeah,
could be. They would have a lot of use for those hand signals, for sure.
Right. And it's weird because like I thought that it'd be a standardized thing. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, because like if you go through diving school, there's all kinds of like universal sign language for divers. You know, like I haven't done my air supplies gone, like all kinds of stuff.
As Marine, you probably also learn that shit, right? Like there's a lot of anybody who's going into space probably needs to learn that stuff.
But they shouldn't call it Belter sign language then. It should just be like, hey, you know, this is like the NATO alphabet. If they called that, like, I don't know, the American sign, the American phonetic alphabet. Well, everyone uses it. So what the fuck? But I don't know.
Yeah, anyway, it's Cyrillic. There are other alphabets, but yeah, I get you.
Yeah. I also think it's like So Alex, let's talk about Alex dying. Mm-hmm. This is clearly, they did not bring Cass Anvar back to be like, hey, look, fucker, you did some dirty shit and you're going to give your character a graceful end note or we're going to, you know what, double fire you.
Right.
They clearly put this together from a few spare frames that they slowed down to suggest that he's just there. And it's, you know, that's what you'd look like if you're dead floating from a massive stroke hemorrhaging out in your brain. Right.
For sure.
And they had, I think they took a couple of his lines where he's in, because they had this thing where he was like shaking his head because he's woozy from the massive breaking run. I think they were going to set all that stuff up anyway. Mm-hmm. But like, yeah, they scrapped together a few like kind of out of context voice clips about him saying that was a hell of a ride. And he kind of felt like he was getting loopy. And then they smash cut to him with some CGI blood. And that's it. Like, it's matter of fact. It reminded me, honestly, of the medic that got killed. I can't even remember the dude's name in episode 4, where it's like,
yeah,
he's a main character and then his head's gone and that's it. Like, yeah, life goes on. This is
as unceremonious as it comes. I dislike how sort of out of the blue it is, although it does make sense. Like if this thing were to happen and it just so happened that it took place off camera, that's what you're going to see if you come back to it. Maybe. Yeah. I don't know about blood and zero G and could it actually drip down his, I don't know. But I'm not going to nitpick. What I do like about this is the consequences of like using the juice and going into high G burns have never actually been realized in this show. They're always talked about.
Right. They're always talked about, yep.
And we've never seen it really affect anybody, other than just like, you know, people grunting because it's stressful.
Yeah, or Avastarala starts to pass out, but you know.
Sure.
Yeah.
But we've never seen, or I think maybe she was bleeding at one point or something, but yeah, we haven't seen it kill anybody. It hasn't been detrimental to that degree. And this felt like, okay, now I get what high G burns can do to you on the juice.
Yeah. And I thought, like, again, it's effective because it's a great way of it's danger in space. You know, I'm sure if this was all intended in the plot, there would be a bigger moment. But honestly, the crew just privately celebrate, you know, privately recognizing his death and coming to grips with it. And you know, hearing he's going to be buried with full Martian military honors, like it's about the best way you can send off Alex in these circumstances. And again, right. like I really liked the way that they found a way to give Alex a nice heroic send off, because again, Alex didn't do a damn thing wrong. And it's just, yeah, all the, I just want to continue to echo the decision to have Naomi, and like, you just see the stars spinning. And then just as you think it's getting to be too late, you know, Bobby smashes into her and you don't even know what's going on at first, but then you do. And then the stars start to slow down and then move in one direction. So it's like, they don't even have to explain. It's just so elegantly done. And, you know, like Bobby's leaning in and saying, you know, you can hear Alex say, is she okay? She's like, I'm not sure. Cause Naomi's just in there blowing snot bubbles. She's like losing her shit.
Yeah.
So much pain and relief. It's great. It's great. Who's not having a good time about this is one Marco, who aboard the Pella is just losing his shit over the Rocinante once again foiling his evil plans. Yeah. But he finds himself impressed with the son's newfound sense of purpose and maturity.
Does he? God, I can't tell.
I don't know, man.
Guy.
I don't fucking know.
He's either gaslighting his son again, or he's actually genuinely impressed with something that, to me, is obvious that Philip is torn up about. Like, Philip is not in a good mental state. You can see it all over his face. You can hear it in his tone. I don't know why Marco thinks he's got any kind of victory here with his son.
I think sometimes narcissists are oblivious to things. And also the fact that, like, Philip is doing the thing that his father's been, like, you know, the fact that he's apparently making this, like, hey, you know what, Dad, here's why I'm not upset. You know, your long-term plan is still in effect and we're still going to win. So fuck the haters, kind of. Like, that's kind of been him saying, like, you can't be emotional. You got to use the thing. You got to use your anger and your pain to, like, he's ostensibly following all those. So, like, it flatters Marco to think that his son is doing so well because of his tutelage and training.
Yeah, it has to be his narcissism getting in the way, because his words are saying that, but his demeanor is saying
face
the
body
exact
language
opposite.
What do you think Philip is thinking here? Because I don't think he's thinking my mom is great and my dad's a bastard. It's just,
oh, there's confusion for sure.
Doubts lingering.
Yeah.
You know, avenues, roads not taken, decisions being questioned. And he knows he's not in a safe environment to express any of that stuff. So he just keeps it all, you know, a lot of times that's the thing of, like, these really controlling narcissistic parents has turned their children into lying machines, you know, bury everything down. Don't give them anything to work with, like, the survival.
And they preface this scene with Philip sitting on his bed, you know, fingering his gun and, like, you know, sitting up in that, like, militaristic, like, hardened posture, as if we're supposed to buy that he has actually turned a corner and he's all in on his dad's mission. I don't buy it.
Well, see, I actually was the opposite. I thought, holy shit, Philip's going to go in there and blow Marco's brains out.
Right. I was confused when nothing happened. Nothing came of that, right? What is that moment?
You're right. You're supposed to show that this guy, like, look, I don't think that Philip knows himself what the hell is going on between his ears, but he is trying to be the brave soldier and, you know, stealing himself for yet another, like, this thing they're doing at the ring gate, which I don't quite fully understand myself, is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, it's like a bigger deal than you can conceive of. Like, imagine if humanity is about to make first contact with an alien species or something, and some person just comes in there and YOLOs the ceremony and blows it up.
Yeah.
You know, like, you fundamentally change the course of human evolution. Your 10 fingers and 10 toes did it.
Mm.
Like, that's kind of crazy. And I think he's stealing himself for that kind of, you know, the stuff his mom's saying about, like, you know, being the death of millions. Like, now you're if you're shutting down the gate to immigration, you're dooming billions of people to poverty and deprivation. And that was before the earth got fucked up. So,
yeah,
one of the big kind of, if we do our after our wrap up podcast, like, that's one of the big kind of, like, questions my mind, disappointments is we don't really know the state of the earth going into season 6. In a series of brief scenes, because this episode gets a little Return of the Kingy with the multiple endings. But in a series of brief scenes, Naomi comes to grips with the loss of Alex. The chain smoker is destroyed, and Naomi plays her "In Case Something Goes Wrong" message for Holden, who didn't have the strength to do it before, as they are burning their way towards Luna.
Yeah, I mean, the real standout scene here to me is Naomi and Holden. Listening to this message together, and you know, knowing that what it meant for them, but also what it means to Alex. It's a good moment. I couldn't help but notice, at least in the copy that I have, the screener copy, which is not a great resolution, I don't think Holden shed a single tear, like actually shed a tear. His eyes got watery. I'll give him that. Naomi shedding tears. I don't know about Holden.
He's have holding we it seen together. Stephen Strait shed a tear?
Probably. Maybe. Why would he?
I'm trying at to this think. Point?
If this won't I'm do trying it, to think. Will.
If we've ever seen like Wes Chatham or Stephen Strait shed a tear.
Not Amos.
He might have, but I don't know. That might be a Holden limitation.
yeah. But regardless, it's a highly emotional scene and it's very good.
And it's so great because it works so good as a way to say goodbye to Alex. Don't waste this love that we've built up between ourselves and grow it. Take what we've got and build on it, because that's how we'll always keep these people alive. And that's how they're going to keep Alex alive. I do wonder going forward if Alex becomes just like a person, you know, persona non grata on the show, or like they do have like tributes to him. Cause I'm completely cool with all like tributes. Like if there's a plaque, mm-hmm. in his honor on the Rocinante, like a little shrine, like I think that would be cool, because again, Alex is not, you know, Cass.
No,
they're not the same people.
They do have a literal plaque in this episode with the names of the crew of the Rossi on it. So he's on there.
Yeah, you know, like I wonder if Amos will like chisel it off. You know, like he did the Martian flag.
Oh no! God!
He's not a crewman anymore, right? You know,
you're not wrong, Amos. You're just an asshole.
Yeah, read the fucking room. Read the fucking room, you meathead. But it's not a lot of time to breathe, because again, they didn't intend to have to do any of this stuff, but like, you know, Naomi, and these are all had to be reshoots, right? Where they're talking about, you know, him dying of a stroke. It could happen to any of us versus, yeah, but he did it saving me from my own mistakes. So I thought that was pretty poignant.
Mm-hmm.
There's also like Bobby's helping Monica unravel the torpedo situation, and Bobby makes a little reference about the Rocinante being an especially tough ship, which that's always nice. They do destroy the chain smoker because it's essentially a continuing hazard to people. And she also worries about being a criminal, and Holden's like, you got valuable intelligence about Marco and all this stuff, and you were a prisoner versus, you know, if you weren't a criminal before, you're not going to be a criminal now.
Is this because of the code that she wrote that was being used in?
I think she's talking about just like being with, like, if you want to be a bloody minded idiot, you could be like, oh, well, she left the Rocinante and joined up with Marco during the asteroid attack during this. Like, you know, he's killed a bunch of Martian ships at this point. Like, there's a lot of blood on her hand. If you want to say that she wanted to rejoin her terrorist old mates, then you could probably make that case.
Yeah, that's a pastor move right there. That's not an Avsarla move.
Yeah, that's some pastor bullshit.
Yeah.
I don't know. I thought it was funny, especially on the second watch, when she's playing these words. It kind of seems like she's got telepathy, right? This is like one of those scenes in Star Trek where Troy and Riker are talking to each other in their heads, because she's just like looking at him lovingly and she's saying, and all these words are playing, and it's just like, yeah, she's like just beaming it into his skull is what it looks like. If you walked in on this scene, you didn't know better, you'd be like, oh fuck, Naomi just got Jean Grey powers. Sure. She got possessed by those fire demons and now she can speak with her mind. Then in a completely different emotional turn, Marco sends a message to Drummer.
Yeah.
This fucking guy.
That he's killed Serge. And she's next, apparently, by the look into the camera that he gives.
His fucking blue steel turn to the camera. Look, I have to take him serious because he's like a murderer. He's a killer.
Oh, yeah. A mass murderer.
The looks on his face sometimes are just so like. It's actually less chilling that you turned to the camera and looked right into it. Like, it was pretty fucking gangster. You spacing this guy and kicking him out the door just to make the point. Like, it'd been, I think, even more badass if he just walks off, but he has to like dramatically turn and stare down the camera. And I'm like, man, I can't wait till you're dead.
I think you look at the camera before you kick the guy out the airlock and then just walk away.
Yeah.
You know, you're not looking at your own explosion, but.
But this sets off a chain reaction in Drummer's family, because Oksana rightfully accuses Drummer of lying. You know, you said you wouldn't put our family at danger over this, and you did, and one of us is dead. Naomi's alive, but one of our family is dead, because of you and your lies. And the Drummer says, well, you know, the thing is there's no place for any of us to go. There's only one side for us to do now. We can still be here, and Oksana, stone cold. We got nothing to stay together for, and her and Vanilla Ice are going to take off on the Defoteng and be gone.
Yeah. But I think her, like her other like main squeeze in this family turns his back on her at this point.
Yeah.
Oksana, yeah. I'm talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. Pete stays with Drummer.
Sure. Pete's sticking behind. So, yeah, I mean, I assume, you know, she's just going to take her ship and go. Right. I don't think there's going to be any further conflict here.
But I do wonder what the fuck she does, because she is. I mean, I guess she could join up with the combined Earther good belter fleet. But it seems like she's going to I don't know what life you can make for yourself out here in between these big war factions.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Like, I guess I shouldn't expect to see her ever again. But yeah, it was sad, and it was a long time coming. But I am excited to see Drummer fighting for the good side. And I also wonder how that looks, because Avasarala in this next scene, you know, there's something else that in like a throwaway scene, we see Avasarala doing this press conference where she's like, hey, people, the belt, let me reassure you that we do not see you all as enemies. And even though we've taken a real strong punch in the nuts, we're not going to go crazy and kill all you people. I wonder how, like, because you've got parts of the belt, parts of Mars that have lost their fucking mind and want blood and vengeance. So you've got maybe the remaining faction of Martians and some factions of Belters and Earth, I guess all of Earth is in the house, not divided. They're going to all. It's going to be interesting to see how all these people, like, this coalition of the willing fights, you know, especially since the Martian separatists seem like all they wanted to do is go through the gate and fuck off and be left alone.
Yeah. Did they say in previous episodes whether they actually hit Pallas and destroyed it?
They did hit Pallas. Yes.
Okay. And they were considering hitting Ceres, right? But they
did not
shut that down.
They did the soft coup. Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, you're going to have a lot of Belters who are really pissed off at them for hitting Pallas.
It's true.
Who knows how many of them they'll get on their side.
Yeah, but I don't know. Like, I'm seeing, like, in the newspaper what I'd think of as a Belter, and I'd see that, like, oh, God, Marco, like, destroyed a good portion of Earth. Oh, God, that's bad. Then Earth destroys Pallas Station. Fuck those guys. They're assholes. But then there's a soft coup on Earth, new management, and they're coming out and be like, hey, sorry about that.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I guess it depends on the Belter, doesn't it? It's going to be really interesting to see what it looks like. Like, how much time elapses. Like, I imagine that you're going to flash forward to, like, the end of this war. Because, you know, there's not enough seasons left to tell, like, a whole big solar system war. You're going to have to, like, you know, hey, there'll be some losses. There'll be a desperate situation, but there's one last thing that's got has to happen, and that'll be next season. That's my bet, anyway.
Yeah, we'll see.
On Luna, Amos parts with his Baltimore brother before being reunited with his real family, which Holden finds to his dismay has just gained a new member. How about that, Holden? How about that?
To the true villains of this season are not the Marcos, but they're the Moon People. You look up, you see a bottle of tequila coming. It's moon gravity. It's falling at like a mile per hour. You catch that bottle. You catch the bottle.
What if you're an Earther refugee, you've never been to the moon, and all you see is you look up and you see this bottle spinning towards you? Like, your reflexes will probably have you just like dodge it, right?
Maybe. I don't know. Have these people ever played baseball? Like, is baseball still a thing? Because, like, you could tell the difference between a 70-mile-an-hour fastball and a 30-mile-an-hour peewee softball pitch. Like,
I'm just saying, something heavy over your head and earth gravity, we've been taught that's a hazard. And, you know, but yeah.
You got, like, 3 seconds to catch it and figure that shit out. Do it, man. That's valuable. You know how valuable tequila is going to be? Like, that bottle's probably enough to get you a year's worth of rations on the moon.
Could be good earth tequila, sure.
Yeah,
sure.
But I did underworld kingpin, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and we've had Chekhov's low G hooch all this season, all building up to the tragedy of Amos's lost tequila. I thought it's good, you know, the fact that, like, you know, Eric and him are on good terms again. You know, like, Eric's going to go out to the frontier, and, you know, just like Mercury said, hey, there's no post offices and no cops out here. Mm-hmm. We are kings. And Amos would probably do really well in that environment. But you know what? He's got his own thing going.
Oh, yeah.
And
the introduction of Clarissa to the Rossi crew is interesting. It's done. The same thing happens in the book, but it's done a little differently, where Holden is given a lot more time to be way more resistant to this idea. In the show, like, I love how Amos distracts him.
I do
long enough for Clarissa to, like, get right up on them almost as she's walking by, to where he's not even going to see her. But he has almost no reaction to it, which is surprising considering his reaction in the book, which is one of,
I thought,
hell no, this is not happening.
Oh, of course. But you know, it's going to happen anyway. So I kind of like the Amos is just like, hey, you remember that time you're going to kill me?
Yeah.
And now that seems crazy. Like, we're like brothers now, right? This is, it's like, and there's no hard feelings, you know, like, people can change, you know, I got your back. And Holden's like, yes, of course, we're family now. Cool. Yeah. I knew you'd see it that way. Come on board, Claire. And the look on it, like, I think it's funnier playing it as fun as comedy, that, like, Holden obviously has a lot of misgivings about this, but, like, mm-hmm. Amos has got him airtight, and all he can do is, you know, like, sit there with a shocked look on his face. And Clarissa lit this sheepish high, and then just as, like, Holden's trying to figure out what to do, like, Amos says, come on, Peaches, come on up, and just, like, drags her right past.
Yep.
It's good. It's good. It, I thought that was very... And then, like, you know, again, if I had my druthers, you'd have, like, a dedicated saying goodbye to Alex kind of thing. Kind of like, you know, where all, you know, you give 10, 15 minutes for us to breathe. But we're not going to get that because it was all emergency jettisoning of Cass Anvar.
Yeah, you
but
want, like, your shooting Spock into space scene, right? That's what you want.
You do. You want Tasha Yar in the holodeck, everyone saying goodbye and getting a speech and all that. But you're not... But, like, this, where, like, everyone kind of talks about, you know, like, oh, you were close, oh, you're this, and oh, well, you know, brave idiots, there's worse than being had, and, you know, going down, standing your ground, protecting your family, all that stuff is great. And then the panning over to the dedication plaque, mm-hmm. the Rocinante legitimate salvage, it's pretty good. Pretty good way to cobble an ending from almost nothing. We got a couple more endings to go. At McAuliffe Lounge on Luna, Avasarala hosts a welcome back party for the Rocinante and holds them up as examples of Belter, Martian, and Earther cooperation.
Yeah, unity is how we win. I mean, this right up Claire's alley, right?
Right. This bar, McAuliffe, is named, I think, after Krista McAuliffe, who is the teacher who lost her life in the first space shuttle explosion.
Huh. Okay.
So I thought that I love how they weave real parts of Terran's history into the show. But yeah, it's my big question coming out of this is, number one, why are they put Bobby in this terrible, terrible Jetsons retro outfit? Holy shit, this is bad.
This is like something out of Space Force, the TV show, right?
Yeah, it's not good. It's not good. I hope she has a better uniform going forward. Second, it sounds like the Rocinante's signed up for the war as a privateer of some sort, which is cool. Very
exactly
cool.
Exactly what you hope for.
Second of all, is Ava Sorala willing to do the things that she's saying she's, because like we pointed out this in the introduction, like the reason Rocinante works is because everyone is equal and everyone's respected. Like, are you willing to commit to that for the belt? Because if not, this is just a bunch of meaningless PR bullshit, which I'm sure the Belters have gotten at least 100 plus years of meaningless PR bullshit. So
yeah, we'll see.
Yeah. And what does that even look like? You know, I don't know.
I mean, she's been the only advocate at the higher levels of government for them during this whole thing. So,
yeah,
I'm hoping so. You know, it's also probably how Holden and the crew of the Rocinante feel. It's how Claire feels, obviously. Like, so many of the forces around here are unifying, and I hope it stays that way.
Yeah. And then we have another ending where Marco and Philip are making a big move at the ring gate. Just as Monica realizes that what we feared for almost a half a season is coming true, the proto molecule is viable and intact and in the hands of bad people. Yeah, this was wild because, again, I thought the show was telling me I don't have to worry about the ring gate. And that was Marco's whole plan. Like, I don't know how he's got this wizardry of micrometeors and stuff. And, you know, maybe it takes a Belter to think about shit like this, like long-term plays using unsecured junk in space, but it fucks. And it's another great battle scene because you see these ships, but they're very tough. These are like dreadnoughts. Like we've very rarely seen like the full Donagers like duking it out. And like, even though they're badly damaged, they're still like handing the Belter fleet its ass until they're stabbed in the back from the ring gate. And that pretty much does it.
His fools.
Yeah,
this is really cool. I love the coordination, the timing that this takes. It shows that, you know, Marco is not just a guy who can get a couple rocks moving. Right. He's got a grand strategy. He has a plan, whether it's, you know, a good one for humanity. Who knows whether it's good for the Belters and himself. I don't know. We'll see it play out. But yeah, I love the coordination that this took.
Yeah, because they're all burnt. They're all going in like dark and like everything is just all coordinated to where it all happens simultaneously. You do wonder, did the ring station, so I wonder how they got messages to ring station without being detected, because you had these ships, like, how do you send a type B message without these ships intercepting it? Like, or was it just like the ring gate decided to go rogue themselves?
Oh, I assume that this was all prearranged.
Right, but how do you prearrange
this particular time? Well, you get your orbital mechanics chart out, right? And you start charting a path.
I'm talking
about
like how did they coordinate with the ring station? Because they're behind a portal. There's three big ships. Like if you wanted to send a message to them, I guess I don't know. There's probably a million different ways.
Yeah, like Anderson Dawes could have done it. Like you can sneak Belters in and out of there,
oh,
right? Because Medina Station
Dawes is in on this.
I don't know, but yeah. I'm just using him as an example of a guy who could have got this done. Like Belters communicating with Belters when you're talking about Medina Station being run by Belters, I think. The back channels in the Belter factions are pretty strong.
Yeah. Real brief ship naming trivia. The Sagar Martha is a Nepalese name for Mount Everest, the highest peak on Earth. That's the Martian Doniger class battleship. And then the two UN Nathan Hale class. Nathan Hale is a Revolutionary War hero, a spy who was executed by the British, named for Tripoli, the capital of Libya. But it's most famous in U.S. military circles for the Barbary Wars, which is like a really foundational piece of military history for the U.S. Navy and the Marines in particular. It's immortalized in the Battle Hymn of the Marines, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. So 600 years later, still looming large in the Navy and the Marines. And then the other ship's name was Montenegro, which is a small Eastern European country along the Mediterranean, bordered by like Serbia and Albania and Croatia. And I have no idea, but sometimes it's cool that there's like, who knows, there might have been a conflict in 2022 or 2222. And who knows, because it's all in the future history. But I thought that was cool.
And you know, you mentioned the protomolecule being in play. I feel like it's on us to kind of mention how it's still in play. There were a lot of people on Reddit who noticed during the Zemea fight that one of those torpedoes they fired had a blue drive plume, which symbolizes an Epstein drive, if I'm understanding this correctly. I didn't know that. I didn't realize that yellow versus blue meant anything other than blue is proto molecule, which that would be insane for that to affect the drive plume. So yeah, maybe it had an Epstein drive on it, was prepared to travel faster and farther than any of those torpedoes.
Going away from the sun out towards the outer planets. And obviously it was intercepted. We found that the Cortazar, that crazy scientist, is, we're jumping a little bit ahead, but this is kind of a nifty little battle, and like we're following it from Avasaralis when they're cheering when the Martians show up, but it's actually the Martian separatist, and they kick their ass in a little bit harder. I felt they did a good job of like showing how you crack this, like, uncrackable defense, because it wasn't just a micro meteors, it wasn't just Marco's fleet, just a Martian's fleet, it wasn't just the ring station rebelling. All of these things had to happen because these are big, powerful ships.
You needed a defection, you needed a ghost knife, you needed another fleet coming in.
But that brief victory turned to when they realized, oh, these are ships are all registered as destroyed in action against Marco.
You find out here, you know, what's in it for Savitaire. We've kept asking, like, what is in it? He wants to preserve the dream of Mars, right? And how is that going to happen? Well, it looks like they've discovered something through one of these gates on another planet, Laconia, that is more protomolecule tech. And they've got, you know, Cortazar, right?
Yeah, Cortazar.
Okay. Out there doing his shit, and then we get like glimpses of it through the cloud, and you know, they finally show it to us at the end. It's some kind of orbital platform that I assume is protomolecule tech.
Is it like a spaceship station? Is it like a giant warship, like unprecedented in size? Like, what the fuck is it all?
Yeah.
Did the Laconia system ring a bell?
It does, but I don't know why.
Well, it's an ancient country, and its capital was Sparta.
Okay.
So I thought like that was a nice little nod, because like clearly this guy is almost setting up like a religious war cult, like his little and I don't know. There's something psychosexual between him and this other lieutenant. Like this is not going anywhere good. Like you get to this extreme and it's going to be crazy and self-defeating, I imagine, but probably in a way that's entertaining and exciting and moves a lot of plot forward next season, I'm sure. They get a hold of Cortazar, cause like they leave with this ominous note of Holden saying, well, maybe they know something about it. We don't. And the smash cut to Cortazar saying, look at all this cool shit I'm building and I'm moving on to phase 3. And oh my God, a Star Destroyer up here. What the fuck?
And they're like, all interconnected, just like Illis. I think that's interesting. So they know of more than like just one.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's a big tease, but it's also like getting me ready for season 6. I'm happy because like a lot of this stuff through book 6 is not in there. The protomolecule is like this big hanging chad of a plot thread at the end of book 6. And I'm looking forward to all of this stuff.
Yeah. This Admiral Salvatar sounds like they've carved out a space that like essentially the Belters want to get a system, and then the Mars is going to get their own, cause they've set up, minefields and whatnot on the side of the ring. It doesn't feel like Marco gets any of the protomolecule. Like Mars is gonna have this Mars faction is gonna have it all.
Yeah,
that's interesting. Like that's a wild imbalance of power.
Well, I think the trade-off here is that the Belt gets everything that isn't Laconia. So they get the ring gate. They get access to all planets.
999 systems.
I think that's what I took away from this, but.
Damn.
I couldn't justify that with like quotes or anything.
I thought so too, but like I wasn't sure why Mars would give that sweet of a deal. Like
protomolecule, baby.
I guess they think that they can like all they need is 100 years in Laconia and they can come out like oorah Spartan and whip everybody else's ass.
Maybe so.
But so like as Admiral Salvatare is explaining the importance of purity and their precious bodily fluids and how he can't be trucking with mom's keepsakes, they transit the ring everything pauses, and these fire demons that we've, these interdimensional fire demons is what I'm calling them, that we've seen, like when that Belter scientist, Aoye, is that what her name, walked into the anti-protomolecule thing last season, what Holden says he sees every time he's transited the gates, that these things are getting angrier. I don't know. It could have destroyed the ship. Mm-hmm. I think that you're seeing these are unseen. These are other dimensional things that are not directly interacting with the matter. And it looks like the ship successfully transmits it. And there's just like these red ripples. But like, this is not good. This is the thing that, you know, the Martians and the Earthers and the Belters are all carving up the systems, and they're completely unaware of this terrifying fire demon extra dimensional bullshit. And I don't know what to make of it.
We'll see. I mean, I'm scared of it. It's the thing that has given the protomolecule so much trouble, and we can't even handle that. So
it took out the ring gate builders. But it's like, it's funny because my reaction is, I remember that when I loved the Expanse so much and this protomolecule started, and it's like, oh, they're going to have these bug eyed aliens from space. I don't give a shit about this. And I was totally wrong about that. That was fucking dope and amazing. Now I'm like, oh, fuck these fire demons. I just want to see the interstellar war. But I'm like, you know, I'm sure it's going to go places too. So last time I talked shit about the protomolecule, it became a jellyfish and opened up a ring gate to the universe. So
don't say anything else, man.
I'll just keep that in my criticism of that in my back pocket. So then for the post credit, it's not really post credit scenes, but instead of the ring gate, we now see this mysterious giant ass suborbital thing that's growing over the Laconia system.
Yeah.
Oh my, what's it going to be? And that's all we got.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Okay, we have some feedback, and this is
awesome.
Not our final episode of the season. We are going to do a wrap-up podcast, so there's one more chance to get your feedback in before we go on hiatus until season 6. If you want to get a message to us, you can do so at expanse@baldmove.com. Just email us there. And we'll pick it up for next week's wrap up, which, you know, those wrap ups are largely driven by the feedback we get. So I'm hoping people jump in and contribute. Let's start off with Caitlin wants to talk about wants to sympathize with Naomi here. Just my two cents from watching Naomi's reaction when waking up. I've never been scuba diving or anything, but I did fly once with a sinus infection I didn't know I had. And once we started our descent, I literally screamed out loud. The kind of thing you would hear dramatized for a horror movie. Not entirely dissimilar to Naomi's scream. It was the worst pain I've ever experienced in my entire life. I immediately began clutching my eyeball out of actual fear that it had just popped out from my head, and I had to keep it in place. It was so traumatizing, I'm still scared to fly without taking a bunch of sinus medication, no matter how I might feel. That's intense.
Yeah, man. Whose call was it to make all these bone chambers that are right next to our eyeballs and our teeth be able to clog up and get squeezed by atmospheric pressure changes? It's I've never had that experience, but holy fuck, I've definitely had bad sinus infections, and without the pressure differential, it's pretty bad. Oh man.
Yeah. And just imagine what it feels like if that's just your entire body, not just your
every joint. Every joint in your body doing that simultaneously. Every filling, every injury you've ever had. It's supposed to be pretty bad.
Fillings? Do they just pop out?
I don't think they pop out. It's just that, like, the gaps in between, like the little mic, like the air, you know, all the places the oxygen and nitrogen can dissolve, start bubbling, and yeah.
Yikes. Jess in San Francisco. I was listening to your podcast this morning and just wanted to add my two scrip. I haven't read the book, so I don't know what's coming up, and this may be totally insignificant, but when Salvatore was lecturing at the university, they spent a good chunk of time on the end of his lecture about holding the ring gates and controlling them with only a few ships. Do you think he was setting up our understanding of how Marco will control the ring with a small force?
Yes. Now that I've seen this episode, all has been revealed, and it kind of, yeah, it shows the asymmetric nature of it, that like you can hold a whole, like you can hold a whole solar system. I guess it wouldn't be a solar system. You can hold a whole star system with just a few mines and a couple ships. Mm-hmm. And also paradoxically, the ring station, the Medina station, was in a great place to defend itself. Like, you know, it took the momentary distraction of these big dreadnoughts and fucked them in the butt with a few well-timed rotten coconuts.
This is basically Deep Space Nine at this point. Like, you've got a station sitting in front of a single entry point with a minefield in front of it. It's Deep Space Nine. I demand Chief O'Brien show up and fix
what's
wrong.
Even had a space station renamed that went from Tarak Nar to Deep Space Nine. You go from, what was it, the Nauvoo to...
The Behemoth to Medina
station. Yeah, it's tracking right on. Drummers, Kieran and Reese, obviously.
Jess finishes up here. I hope that Amos hooks up with Peaches. And although I agree with your comments about Eric not really having a part to play moving forward, I like him and hope he will stay on. Scratching my head why he hasn't grown a new arm. He's an inner. He's got money. I don't know either.
You might not be. You might like it. You might like the grizzled, scarred kind of. You know, more intimidating that way.
The most interesting thing to talk about here is Amos and Peaches. Will Amos ever find love in this show? Is that what Amos's arc is all about?
I think Amos has a healthy separation between sex and love.
He certainly does.
Growing up in brothels, being a frequent participant and patron of one, I think he knows that love and sex are sometimes linked, but don't have to be. And if if Peaches wants to activate her tongue thing and throw him around the quarters, I think throw him through a structural wall or two, I think he would be down for that.
I don't know. He's eaten too many peaches at this point for me to believe that he wouldn't be shitting where he eats. You know, his comment about that in season four makes me think that that would be a very bad idea. Unless you can link it up, unless the love comes first, right?
Amos is a man of contradictions, because he says this, like, I don't shit where I eat. But also he told Holden, like, wait, Naomi would fuck me? Like, you know,
Sure, there's an implication there that he'd be down for it. Yeah.
Right. So I, you know, I don't think that's a hardened. It's more of the those pirate rules. They're more of like, you know, guidelines than actual, you know, real legal consequences.
All right. There's also some more stuff here about potentially Eric's role. So John G says, I was thinking about Jim's question about what happens with the crime lord from a region of Philadelphia, where his power is based on that region and what he's established there. Arriving on Luna, which must already have its own underworld and some kind of existence, existing balance of power. What can these newbies really do to get a foothold? It made me think of the early mafia in the US and how it was roughly balanced between Irish, Italian, and Jewish factions for much of the 19th and early 20th century that did fight each other for turf, but it was usually not a protracted war. Then, in the 1920s, Prohibition happened. You have a very thirsty country and now an illegal substance that people really want. That created a vastly profitable but limited new illicit market and a strong incentive to dominate it, resulting in big mafia turf wars and lots of death. In The Expanse, Luna is not just going to have this influx of new criminals, but a huge general influx of refugees, and those refugees are going to need things that will stress the existing system well beyond its capacity, opening up new avenues for organized crime that didn't exist in the previous balance. Especially if many of the arrivals are rich people with private orbital shuttles and a desire to reallocate relocate, and they have lots of cash. People are going to be herded into overcrowded shelters, and there will be many new opportunities to service the needs of those who can pay. In a sense, Prohibition has just come to the moon. How do you feel about this?
I mean, I think more Eric would be cool. I actually think, and before like the end, the very, very end of this, where it seems like the gate is going to slam shut for everybody, but except Belter interests, I thought maybe it'd be cool to, like, you know, this is going to be like a multi-system war. Like, you need like multiple fronts and people to represent those. Like, Eric being kind of like the gray market, black market runner in one of these systems would be kind of cool. I don't know. And like, This is all great analysis, but this last episode is a game changer. And I think that like Luna and its the criminal stuff is like small potato steaks. Like, it would be like a more pointless version of Bobby's plot at this point. What do you think?
I mean, I just think it's hard to. The choke point here is the ports, right? It's much like Medina Station, where if you can hold down the ring, the entrance to the solar system and the entrance to the ring gates, you hold down everything. Marco knows that. And I feel like the power structures, like, think about Anderson Dawes at Sirius Station, right? He owned the docks. He owns the ports. It's tough to get anything into Sirius like it would be on Luna. To get past him, and those existing power structures have that stranglehold. I don't know. I still see a big uphill climb for Eric if he's going to get any foothold here, because he's out of his element at this point.
But on the other hand, he is good at, you know, the churn, and this is like a big churn now. Now you got all like an entrenched warfare. There's no. The balance of power has been completely flipped over. But like I said, is that a necessary part of the story they need to tell? I don't know, because
it's a good question. I would watch it for sure.
Yeah, Eric would be cool, but they only have one season left. That's the thing that I also think, like, man, it seems like they could easily make a meal out of this battle, but like I've doubted The Expanse before's ability to tell a tale in a finite amount of time, and boy, like, this episode felt like they covered light years of territory. I didn't expect it. It's like, five of the six endings we got, I did not expect.
Right. It does feel like if he's going to get into this power structure, he needs to start kind of at the bottom, in the middle somewhere. He's not going to be able to straight away carve out his own thing. He's going to have to, you know, especially get the lay of the land, understand the dynamics at work here. There will be some time just figuring it all out and probably working his way up through the ranks like he did before in Baltimore. We'll see. Speaking of C is our next emailer. Just C. And they say Chloe from San Francisco. Never mind. Your name was right in the beginning. sharing some thoughts on why Naomi Nagata is such a great character. I always love to see female leads in shows. Naomi is a brilliant engineer. Her conversations are inevitably past the Bechdel test. And although her boyfriend, Holden, is arguably the lead of this ensemble cast, she is a three-dimensional character in her own right. But this week's episode of Hard Vacuum made me appreciate her in new ways. I first heard about the concept of strong female lead from Britt Marling, co-writer, producer, and lead of The OA. As Marling wrote in the New York Times opinion piece, a strong female lead is an assassin, a spy, a soldier, a superhero, a CEO. She can make a wound compress out of a maxi pad while on the lam. She's got MacGyver's resourcefulness, but looks better in a tank top. The problem is that she's only allowed a narrow specificity of strengths, physical prowess, linear ambition, focused rationality, traditionally masculine modalities of power. Best example I can think of is Starbuck from Battlestar Galactica, for sure. It's difficult to...
River Tam.
Yep. It's difficult for us to imagine femininity itself, empathy, vulnerability, listening as strong. Marling explains, this is where Naomi Nagata comes in. Marco and by proxy Philip talk about being strong, but as Naomi points out, killing people doesn't mean you're strong. In contrast, she has the strength to help and protect other people, no matter what race or creed. She unconditionally loves the son who was stolen from her and turned into a monster, and she risks her life to save him, but she leaves him for a second time when she sees there's no other choice. She fights beyond the limits of normal human capacity to disable the chain smoker booby trap, and she does it while wailing and crying with tears running down her face. Physically and emotionally wrecked, she hatches a plan that just might get them all out of there alive. I agree.
Yeah, excellent analysis. And I also really like that point they make about how these strong female characters have essentially just been the same action type of heroes and anti-heroes it's just men with mm-hmm. the better looking tank tops. And Naomi does seem like she is that different. And I think also in our, look, buckle up people, the rest of our lifetime is going to be coming to grips with the questioning of gender dichotomies.
Yeah.
Like the writing's on the wall, like this idea that like strength is this and empathy is that, like that's all going to go to fucking way of the dodo. That's going to look like bad race science from 100 years ago, 100 years hence, I feel like. So since the Expanse is playing 400 years in the future, this stuff is all very super appropriate.
Yeah. And honestly, it's the portrayal here of Naomi is better, I think, in the show than in the books. So I'm glad they went with this and changed it up.
It's wild because in the first two or three books, I thought the reverse, like most, like they gave Naomi all of the dumb, selfish decisions that the group collectively made. And in the book, it was a lot more nuanced, but it's nice that maybe they're swinging the balance back the other way.
Mm-hmm. All right. Rish says, can we all agree that Holden's outfit is straight up terrible? It's like some weird pseudo Batman outfit. At the very least, I'll say this, Sting wore it better in Dune.
It's Martian hard vac armor, and we've seen it since the first season. This is what it looks like. I don't know.
Why is he the only one wearing it?
Because he's the only one that's got, I mean, everybody else has their belter shit and their Tyco shit that they're wearing. Wasn't Bull wearing this stuff too? I thought Bull was wearing the black Martian armor.
I don't think so. I think Bull is wearing a saggy jumpsuit. Also, I can totally see your criticism of the setup of the Chetsmoka. Why breaking everything on a ship that is utilized as a bomb? Why break everything on a ship that's utilized as a bomb and no one is supposed to be aboard? Good question. But I think we need to keep in mind the belter habit that nothing goes to waste. While the ship looks smashed up, I wonder if in reality it's more scavenged than smashed. This would fit more nicely into the lore of the universe and explain why there was a quote-unquote puzzle left behind for Naomi to solve.
That if they had made the decision, like all the control panels are gone.
Right.
But I just keep coming back that they needed, like, cause like if they didn't say there's a tamper resistant mechanism, I just think that like Naomi just hotwires shit.
Yeah.
And they have to throw that in, but that like they're just, I feel like that they're trying to square off a corner or round off a corner that just can't quite be rounded. And it's fine. It's not like I said, all in all, everything really works. I'm not going to think about the grates and the tamper seals and all that shit when I think about season five of The Expanse. So it's fine. I don't know. If I had Dan and Ty, I would love to talk to them about like how much of that stuff they were aware of in the writer's room. How much of that stuff did they think that they were communicating because, you know, they wrote the books and they knew how it, and but you know, they could also say, hey, it's dramatic license. You know, we used to let shows get away with dramatic license, you know, sound in space is dramatic license.
Not anymore. Damn it. We want realism.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just going to shout out a few people, Ryan, Am, Josh, and David, who all wrote in about, Lake Winnipesaukee and, the Holmes and the, you know, the idea that there are islands in this lake and this is like really grounded in reality. As far as Claire having a house there with a launch pad. So thank you. We got tons of emails about that. And it's so like we mentioned it in last episode, we kind of corrected ourselves. So I just wanted to, let them know. I got your email.
We got some Avasaralas and some Mals writing in talking about their, space yachts they got parked in Lake Winnipesaukee, and
yeah, I mean, not too far from it, but sure.
How many winter servants do you maintain in those properties, sirs and madam?
I don't know about winter servants, but there's summer homes for sure.
There you go. Winter staff then.
Jack writes in, my wife is an elementary school teacher here in Los Angeles, West Hollywood, at the Center for Early Education, an elite private elementary school. It turns out Ravetta Bowers was a teacher and head of the school for 40 plus years and was brought back out of retirement this year to stabilize things for the A+ list clientele. And he lists a bunch of them. Most powerful power couple there is. He's a rapper. She's the world's most famous singer.
Jay-Z and Beyonce.
He doesn't say. He also says a world famous SNL actor. The creator of a show about an American workplace. And a rage guitarist. All high profile people. The connection to the show and the school is simple. The director of this and many past Expanse episodes, Breck Eisner, which is the son of Michael Eisner, is a current parent at the school. My wife taught this child a couple of years ago. I guess this was a little kiss ass move on his part or wink, but I think the former. Sorry for the mini rant. We were literally having a discussion about Ravetta before watching the show. Then I noticed it all over the ship. We were listening to your pod in bed and hearing you attempt to figure out the meaning, and we burst out laughing. So I had to let you know.
So well, this is kind of like a rich insider thing, more than this person did a long history of like slaving for, that's probably a poor choice of your words, serving the California school systems.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Interesting. Sounds like it.
All right. Yeah.
They just right, so know each other.
And shit. I see it. I get, I'm hearing what they're saying.
Alan C says, I know you guys have discussed a few times who will replace Alex as the pilot. It seems like Bull would be able to slide into that seat pretty easy, but I think there are a couple characters we have known longer than Bull that would be a better fit.
So hey, too bad. He's already slid in the seat. He's drinking the man's coffee.
That doesn't mean he has to stay there. The first two characters that come to mind are Clarissa and Bobby. Both have shown themselves on the show to be decent pilots. Both seem like they might inevitably end up calling the Rossi home next season, and we know both better than we know Bull. I think Bobby fits the pilot seat best since she is already familiar with Martian tech and military procedure. He also says, who knows, maybe Naomi's son ends up being a hotshot pilot full of teen angst, and he can come pilot the Rossi.
I mean, those are all really good ideas. I do think that like it seems that the Bobby and Clarissa have probably something to do in the books, and Bull like is going to, I think Bull's just straight up going to be Alex.
I think so. Yeah, I'm with you. I'm all in on Bull at this point. Like I like Bobby and Claire, and I think either of them would be good choices, but we've got Bull.
What if they recast Bull with someone half as cool and colorful next?
Oh,
the dude they pulled like June on
Bull
us.
June. They can't they have pull, a Bull they, June.
They just slide Blah June right into the Bull.
Oh no.
It'd be funny. They just recast him as the same guy. It's like he's just
that's just a middle just finger.
He's just the hot swap actor on the Expanse. Your main acting unit flies apart. You just put Blah June.
Yeah.
And Bolt Najun.
They'll name him Alex His first name's Alex. It's Alex Bull. No.
Alex P. Bull.
I hate it so much.
Nope. Yeah, it's probably what they're going to do then.
All right. Chris in Australia has some interesting stuff here that I actually didn't know about their landing. When we were discussing the launch of the luxury space dinghy from the lake house, he said it was poor design that the exhaust from the engine destroyed the launch facility in the house along the pink water security. We saw when the Rossi landed on Illis that the ships with an Epstein drive don't use the drive itself to affect the landing. The plume is too dangerous. What we've seen in the show at least once and a bunch of times in the books, exhaust plumes either being used as an improvised weapon or specific dialogue about moving to a safe distance before kicking in the Epstein drive. Mm-hmm. Says, I believe that the ships are shown to take off and land using the tea kettle method, where superheated steam is used to provide thrust. The tech is what was that?
Yeah, those like RCS thruster type deals.
I guess RCS typically steam.
Reaction, I think this means a reaction control system. But those might be not tea. Like when he says tea, because he's talking about literally boiling water. Because I think a lot of the thrusters on modern ships use like peroxide, some kind of peroxide reaction. But I could be wrong.
All right. He says it's safe to use in proximity to things you don't want slagged. And then when Peaches starts up that launch sequence, it's taking too long. And that's probably what they're going to do is take off with that tea kettle method. But instead, they go with the full Epstein, thanks to Eric. Anyway, let's move on to Scott. He said you talked last week about the relationship between Earth and Belt's dependency for food, etc. The show has leaned heavy into this side of the relationship, but you've also laid the groundwork for Earth needing the Belt. The main reason for colonizing Illis was the enormous amount of lithium that needed to be mined. And it stands to reason that 24 plus billion people on Earth, there is a need for minerals that the planet cannot meet. What I love about the show is the parallels to the real world. USA and China are easily Earth and Mars, while the Belt could be any number of African or South American countries that are exploited for their minerals, specifically lithium for the growing need in electric vehicles.
Sure.
I wonder how big of a part that's going to play. Like you can see with like the devastating effects on Earth, the resources might get tight at some point. And they mention it, right? Like that's one of the things that the drummer's crew mentions when they confront Marco for the first time. Like, do you have a plan for this? He says he has a plan and he's, you know, shown himself to have plenty of plans before.
It's true.
A big one at the end of this. So I don't know. We'll see. Joe D says, hey guys, now that we're headed into the sixth and final season of The Expanse, I find myself for some reason thinking about the infamous criticism that George R. R. Martin had about the Lost finale. I know he probably shouldn't be named around here, but here's his quote. We watched it every week trying to figure it out. And as it got deeper and deeper, I kept saying they better have something good in mind for the end. This ending better pay off here. And then I felt so cheated when we got to the conclusion. I have all these readers who are waiting on the book, talking about his books at this point. I want to give him something terrific and then pause in the dialogue here. What if I fuck it up in the end? What if I do a Lost?
No.
Then they'll come after me with pitchforks and torches. Boy, this has not aged well, has it?
I mean, this guy talked a lot of shit about J.R.R. Tolkien and, you know, his post Return of the King, like, oh, what's Aragorn going to do with the tax rates? What's he going to do with the orcs? What's he going to do? And he's talking mad shit about the Lost finale.
I know. It really doesn't age well with what's happened with Game of Thrones. But Joe,
meanwhile,
has
Dan and Ty are about to spike the football on the last installment. Like, fuck yeah.
Right. So this is Joe's question here. Because the source material for season 6 of The Expanse is already on the shelf and Ty seems to be super involved with the production of the show, are you hopeful that the final season and finale will be epic enough to catapult the series up to the levels of Breaking Bad or The Wire? Not sure if that's aiming too high, but I'm wondering if you think The Expanse has the potential to be one of the best sci-fi shows of all time, if they're in fact able to stick the landing in the final season.
Well, I will point out that The Wire wasn't The Wire throughout its broadcast history. It's not like The Wire had 50 million people watching it, hanging on its every word. True. The Wire grows and grows and grows in people's minds because everyone sees it and says, oh shit, this is like the best television show we ever said. It's very relevant because can't fucking fix any problem that we have here in America. Any kind of long-term systemic one, apparently. So it'll keep being relevant probably for at least 20 years in the future, at least until they get right about this war on drugs thing. I got to say, after this season, I am utterly confident that season 6 will be a fully satisfying journey, and that there will be breadcrumbs for some, you know, for some future endeavor. And hell, they might work out some of the Amazon. But I just cannot believe the season 6 isn't going to be amazing. Like season 5, like if this is the uneven season, had everybody worried, I'm not worried anymore. Yeah. Because this finale, like this, the way these guys can just like accelerate and effortlessly crunch through so much exposition and material when they need to is, I think, amazing. Mm-hmm. I've not seen a show that does it like this. Yeah, but like again, 20 years ago, The Wire wasn't like everyone's consensus best show ever. It was like a cult thing that like 500,000 people were watching on Showtime, you know. Yeah, The Sopranos are sucking up all the oxygen. So I don't know why The Expanse won't continue to grow and grow and grow in people's imagination. Because if you see it, if you get through those first four episodes, you're a fan for life. And I don't think they're going to disappoint people. And you know, as Star Trek and Star Wars continued to kind of flail and flounder and do this and that, like, here's this superior thing, this more adult, mature thing, more realistic thing. And I feel like it'll just keep growing.
Yeah, I was reading some interviews with Dan and Ty, or maybe it was on their podcast. I listened to one of those. But they were talking about how they did have an ending for the broad strokes of this show, where they want it to go. So they're not kind of fumbling around in the dark here toward the end. And I feel like that should give them some confidence to steer this to an end point, as opposed to having to make one up on the fly. Because they have been steering that way for a long time. So they've got that momentum. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, the prolific nature of their writing. They put out a book a year. They're big books. They're as big as anything Martin's ever written, and each one seems to be better than the last. So I don't know. I mean, it would be a shame if the ending was just not satisfying, but I have a lot of faith in these guys.
Yeah, it'd be far more shocking at this point than Game of Thrones, because Game of Thrones, you know, looking back, like, oh, you know what? The last 2-3 seasons were kind of in a trajectory that we were hoping was going somewhere else. Whereas, you know, these last, I mean, even this season, I think it's been a fucking banger. Mm-hmm. So it would be a real shock if the last season just left you kind of like, I don't even want to rewatch this show. I don't want to read the books. I don't want, like, that'd be a hard one. I mean, it's possible, but I think at this point, if you're going in thinking that's going to happen, it's, you know, you're looking for trouble.
And I think as far as like it turning out to be one of the best sci-fi shows of all time, I think it's their race to lose at this point. You know, like they're on that list so far for me. If they can stick any kind of decent landing, I think they get there. And that's it for the emails. That's all we got this week. Like I said, we will be back to discuss this in more depth next week. So stay tuned.
So stock those emails in expanse@baldmove.com. Cause like I said, I think I want to have some thoughts, because I've got a lot of stuff that I'm curious about. I haven't done a lot of Reddit deep dives this year, because we've been doing all this stuff mostly in advance. And I'd also, like, I'm just deathly afraid of spoiling myself. I had a near run around episode 3, and this fucking Ralph P. Macchio crap, this Macho Peru, this whatever, this munch and plowing thing. I don't know what's going on. That's the thing. I've been terrified. Like, I don't want any context of it. I don't like, because I keep having flashbacks to the Red Wedding, and how that, like, just even getting the term, seeing the term, and just then seeing it in context, like it spoiled me before I was ready on the so I'm really trying to stay pure.
I would warn you off hyping that up too much in your head, because a lot of it has already happened.
Ralph P. Macchio is here right in front of me.
Ralph P. Macchio is standing in front of you, sidekicking his highest, and you're not even taking notes.
Jesus. Gosh.
Yeah. Right, so
The Karate Kid. It's right beside me. All right. Well, that'd be interesting. Yeah. So I've so far I have zero clue about what's going on in the last book. I'm gonna try to keep it that way. But yeah, I got some things I want to research and talk about, and hopefully you guys will too. Expanse at baldmove.com. We'll be back to wrap up this season. And if this is the last that we see of you, just know that we're going to have lots of great movies coming up in 2021 of Bald Move. We're going to go revisit The Walking Dead pretty soon. It's going to be fun. And there's all kinds, like, as soon as they start producing new stuff, we're going to be all over that as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we'd love to have you along long term on the Bald Move long range freighter to a new system. To the Lacona system, where a dishonorable discharge is a bullet or worse. Follow us on Twitter, Bald Move, and check out our website if you want to keep up what's going on. And also this weekend, if you want to do like some concentrated forms of Bald Move celebration, we're doing a 24-hour marathon to benefit a Alzheimer's charity where we're watching all the Star Trek movies, essentially. We're going to start that on noon on this coming Friday, and we're going to finish it up on noon on Saturday. We're going to be wrecked. We're going to try to raise a lot of cash for the research Alzheimer's, and then we're going to get 24 hours of sleep and come back this Sunday for Sci-Fi Sunday to watch this here episode and discuss it. And also, don't forget about our stereo.com/baldmove after show. 11 p.m. on Sundays, where we're going to be talking about this episode of The Expanse, the future of the show, where it's going, live audience interaction. It's really cool. Check that out too. So we'll see, if nothing else, back next week for the wrap up. And until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later, everybody.